different points of view. The format that we had on Tuesday seemed to work well, so I'm gonna stick with that. We start out with each of the panelists talking for about 10 minutes, and then if there's, you know, if the panelists want to get in a quick rebuttal, we can give them a chance to do that, but then we'll open it up to more for comments and questions from the audience, and then we'll wrap up with statements from the panelists. If any of you don't know any of our panelists, we have Marcus Mueller at the end, Howard Barnum, Lucian Hardy, and Raphael Sorkin, and Marcus has bravely agreed to go first.
Okay, thank you. So I would like to add just one aspect to the discussion, which is in a sense a follow-up to what Terry Rudolph said on Tuesday in the panel discussion. And it's just a very, very personal point of view on generalizations of quantum theory. So I'm pretty sure that many of you will have a totally different opinion and not agree at all. And I think that's fine. So let me just start with one observation that I find very interesting. And this observation is basically that quantum theory seems to be extremely fine-tuned to fit into space-time. So what do we mean by fine-tuned? So let me give you two examples. So the first example is called the no-signaling principle. So as like all of you know, in quantum theory, if you have an entangled state that's shared between two parties, then we have non-locality in the sense of Bell. So the entangled state can violate Bell inequalities, but still we have the no-signaling principle respected. So there is no way for Alice to send information to Bob in a superluminal way just by choosing her measurements. And I think this is really remarkable. So if we just write down an ad hoc theory, just a naive theory, a classical theory, that tries to explain how do we distribute non-local correlations to the parties, then usually these theories will also allow signaling. And the fact that quantum theory does not allow that is, I think, very interesting. And you can say this is a minimal requirement for having at least a minimal amount of peaceful coexistence between quantum theory and relativity. Now this is one example of this fine-tuning. Now the second example is that quantum theory carries representations of the space-time symmetries. Yeah. So if you look at a qubit, like a spin 1/2 particle, for example, then its state space is really just a Euclidean ball, and this Euclidean ball just carries a representation of the rotation group. Now if you look at some of these toy theories that people have studied, for example PR boxes, then these theories may satisfy the no-signaling principle, but in general they do not have these representations. PR boxes, for example, would have state spaces that are really just boxes, like squares, and you cannot find symmetries, enough symmetries, to represent the space-time symmetries. Now, this is, I think really remarkable. There should be really a close connection between these two fields. Now, why am I saying that? So why? What is this telling us? And this is really just a very personal motivation to study these generalizations of quantum theory. So there's obviously this field of quantum gravity, where people are trying to combine quantum theory and space-time into a theory that works. And what I find personally a bit odd is that in many of these approaches, there seems to be a consensus that the GR part, the part that talks about space-time, has to be modified in the fundamental theory. But quantum theory is assumed to just survive as it is. I'm not saying this is in all approaches the case, but in many approaches this is the case. So maybe this fine-tuning tells us that we should be more open to the idea that maybe both parts of the theory will be modified in the fundamental level. So maybe we have some fundamental level, and then after some coarse graining, we get a smooth picture of space-time, and under the same coarse graining, the world will look quantum, which would tell us that it makes sense to look for generalizations of quantum theory that would remain valid in this other realm. So this also goes back to what Terry said on Tuesday. So Terry said that, so he pointed out that there's this problem of making sense of quantum theory, and he said maybe it's space-time that is the red herring. So maybe our problem with understanding quantum theory comes from the idea that when we think of hidden variable theories, we think of that as embedded in the usual space-time picture. But we know from Bell's theorem that this is impossible. So maybe we should think of a different way of looking at possible underlying theory. Now what do we do with that? So how do we make progress? So as like many, many people here probably, I would try to argue that we should take an operational information theoretic point of view on these things to make some progress. And what convinced me of that idea is basically some analogy. I know this analogy is not perfect and it's historically not accurate, but it's at least for me a motivation to look at these operational generalizations of quantum theory. So just imagine you go back 100 years and suppose we have just discovered the Lorentz transformations. So then you have a strange situation. You have like the usual idea of geometry, like Euclidean geometry that we all have a good idea about, and then the set of ad hoc rules that's called the Lorentz transformations, which just seems to describe experiments very well. And you could react in different ways to that. You could say, well, Lorentz transformations are just strange. For example, they don't answer the question, if I have two events, A and B, does event A happen first or does B happen first, or is it the other way around? Then you might say, oh, that's strange. That means it's not a good theory because I cannot answer this question anymore. Well, you could do that, but you could also have another approach and you could just study the Lorentz transformations. And in the end, you could find out, hey, it actually makes sense. All that we have here is just some theory of geometry. And it's actually just one example in a large landscape of theories of geometries. And then you could try to study those theories, those Riemannian or semi-Riemannian theories of geometry, and try to see if that says something interesting about physics. And as we know today, this kind of approach is actually a fruitful one. And now for me at least, one motivation is to say that maybe we're in a similar situation. So if it's two theories, which one of them is basically classical probability theory, or classical way of reasoning about the world, and then there's this set of ad hoc rules called quantum theory, which works perfectly and for many experiments. And as I would argue is that in the last few decades we have kind of learned that quantum theory is in a sense just an example of a theory of probabilities, at least to some extent. And so again, just by analogy, it seems interesting to me, or like fruitful, just to study the set of all probabilistic theories where quantum theory is embedded. So I would say this has already brought some progress. For example, we understand quantum theory now much better from this perspective, because we can give a few simple axioms, for example, that will pick out quantum theory. And also like people like Raphael has done this, for example, we can invent new experiments just by looking at those surrounding theories. And then you could, for example, try something like testing for third order interference, which people are actually doing in the lab now. Yeah. So I think we should, so this is at least for me the motivation to study these theories more, and maybe even talk to people who are doing quantum gravity and trying to get, yeah, talk to them. Like,
have we met?
Let's have a coffee afterwards, yeah. And try to see what this could tell us about fundamental physics. Okay.
Thank you. Howard.
All right, well, Marcus touched on several things that I also wanted to mention. I wanted to emphasize that I think it's important for those of us who work in constructing generalizations, say within this convex operational framework that Alex just talked about, which is the one that I tend to work in, or in other ones like category theoretic formalism, which is related to the operational one. Particularly in those two sort of programs, I think it would be nice if we tried to make more connection to space-time physics. And so in that regard, I noticed that, you know, a lot of the other sorts of generalizations people are talking about, these collapse models and so forth, Bohmian theory would be another example. You know, there's a special role given to position. Or maybe, you know, some versions give a special role to position and momentum. And, you know, here we are talking about finite dimensional Hilbert space. So I think finite dimensional Hilbert space is a great place to start and understand that first, but it would be nice to start trying to coordinate things with space-time. And so one sort of conservative way to try to do that might be to take some of these structures, these operational models for a system, and try to relate them to other, try to see if you can fit them into a space-time model. So, for example, if you think about algebraic quantum field theory, you're associating algebras of operators, maybe C star algebras or something like that, to regions of space-time that satisfy certain conditions. And you might ask, and then, you know, these algebras where the regions overlap, they have to behave a certain way, and where they don't overlap, they have to, you know, be related in another way. And so you might ask, well, what if I try to do this with these, you know, some class of operational or category theoretic objects, operational models or something? Can I even successfully do this? Does it put constraints on the sort of the toy model? Are the constraints sufficient to actually get us down to quantum theory and maybe help explain, you know, why we've got these algebras are actually C-star algebras? Or, I don't know, maybe if you like topological quantum field theory, you might look at, and maybe you like to formulate these operational theories as an algebra where sort of the interpretation of the objects is very simple. They're like systems and there are different sites, and you know, maybe if Alice gets two systems together, then she gets to do global operations on this tensor product of them, or the monoidal product in the category theory. And you know, maybe then if she sends one to somebody else, she can no longer operate on it, and that person can operate on the collection of systems they have. I mean, that's sort of a very simple, you know, there's hints of space-time in it, but that's not really space-time. So you might, you know, but it can be formulated perhaps as a symmetric monoidal category. Well, what if you look at, you know, some other category theoretic construction and try to make a functor from that to, you know, some category that represents space-time? So I'm thinking John Baez has some ideas along these lines where, you know, this category of cobordisms and, well, it's a self-dual category, and you can view a topological quantum field theory of a standard sort as a functor from Hilbert spaces to this cobordism category. So just ideas like that for actually trying some concrete things and getting these operational, more general than quantum structures, you know, trying to get space-time in there. Or, you know, just talk more about energy in theory. So there's actually an interesting, you know, again, in the Jordan framework, in fact, an interesting way, which is not obviously related to local tomography, although I think it is, of getting standard quantum theory, of singling it out from the other Jordan theories, I believe, or more generally, a C-star algebra, is you ask that the generator of the reversible transformations, so you think about the reversible transformations of the space of normalized states, that's like tasting it in quantum mechanics, that's rho goes to u rho u dagger, right? Where rho is the density matrix and u is unitary. Well, these other Jordan theories have operations like that too. The interesting thing is that their generators, unlike in the quantum case, are not necessarily observables. And so there's probably a lot of physical significance to that distinction that could help you single out standard complex quantum theory from the other Jordan algebraic theories in a way that doesn't explicitly refer to local tomography. Although I think it's, in the end, I think it's actually related to the lack of local tomography because, well, I won't go into the mathematics, but so, right, trying to get related more to you know, meaty physical concepts like space-time, energy, momentum, and so forth. And perhaps related to that, I think we ought to be thinking a lot. So if you look at a lot of the axiomatizations which lead to quantum theory or Jordan theory or whatever, a lot of the axioms have the flavor of things that should be related to, you know, that might be related to thermodynamics, right? They have to do with, oh, there's a whole lot of reversible transformations. Or we can purify any state to a pure state. So you start thinking, well, maybe that will help me, you know, deal with Maxwell Deemann's arguments by invoking reversibility at a higher level. And actually a whole host of other things that suggest, you know, maybe maybe they would be related to having a nice thermodynamic. So, for instance, Marcus and Kazmin Udadek, who was at the time a postdoc at PI, and I have a yet another characterization of Jordan algebra, which is probably related to some earlier ones, but in terms of three simple axioms. And one of them is that any set of perfectly distinguishable states, pure states, can be taken to any other set of perfectly distinguishable pure states of the same size by a reversible transformation. The second one is any state can be expressed as a convex combination of mutually perfectly distinguishable states. So that's kind of a spectral decomposition. Every state has a spectral decomposition. And I believe that's also something that Alex gets from other axioms, perhaps. But it's a sort of a step in he's got it in terms of some other things, but it's a step there. Those are two. And then if you use an axiom, so given those two axioms, you have these nice things that are like the projections onto a subspace of Hilbert space, or projection onto the density matrices supported on a subspace. You can call them compressions or filters. They're very nicely behaved idempotent operations. And so those have to exist for every face of your convex state space. And if you impose that those projections actually have to preserve purity of states, right, even if the state isn't in the image, in which case it has to be undisturbed, even if it is disturbed, it still remains pure if it started out pure. So you might think, well, that might have some relevance to some thermodynamic story I want to cook up where I, I'm trying to gain information about the state of a system without disturbing the state by maybe doing one of these, doing a measurement where I decompose the space according to these projectors and see which one I project into. Anyway, those three axioms get you Jordan algebraic systems. So paying more attention to thermodynamics and media physics in general. How am I doing for time?
A few more minutes,
okay. So those are the things that sort of have to do with the project of these generalized theories. Maybe I want to say a few more general things about quantum mechanics that I've just and generalized theories that I've observed during the meeting. I really liked, as did Marcus, I really liked Terry's point about, maybe the hidden variables, the ontic things, are not going to be space-time things. I've long felt that was a very appealing possibility, but not really had any idea as to what they should be. I think maybe we should think a little bit more about sort of this relational idea of fundamental decoherence. This is something I haven't worked on, but I find it really appealing. And when Marcus Arndt mentioned yesterday this Ferrari that you would try to, if you were going to try to do an interferometry with a Ferrari, you would need, to let the thing keep flying for 30 trillion times the size of the universe. I mean, that sounds to me like it's pretty close to an in principle impossible experiment. And so maybe some of the maybe some of the not only do unperformed measurements have no outcomes, but impossible measurements should also have no outcomes. Maybe some of the not being able to have macroscopic superpositions that would make us feel better about quantum mechanics. I mean, maybe that comes from the fact that there really is no operational meaning to this superposition because there really would be no way to observe it. I don't know if that could be related to some topological quantum field theory idea where the quantum state of the universe is a one-dimensional Hilbert space because there's nobody to observe it, but there are Hilbert spaces or whatever associated with, cuts between observer and observed portions of the universe. Those are ideas. That's an idea I think should be explored more. And related to that, even if you do succeed in making some really incredible interference, and I noticed that none of the experimentalists have made any such claim, but you shouldn't necessarily take it as a claim that the same sorts of superpositions exist outside the lab where maybe there's an interaction of a similar sort. So, you know, just even if David Deutsch, you know, succeeds in interfering, you know, some guy observing one result of an experiment and observing the other result, and then he interferes them back together, and the guy goes, oh, I saw something, but I can't remember what it was. Just the fact that you can do that, okay, it is sort of a proof in principle that you can superpose people seeing different things, but it doesn't mean that we're actually in that state, you know, when we interact with photons and other quantum particles. So more thought about relational decoherence would be neat, I think, and probably I should stop there.
Thank you. Lucien.
Okay, so the problem with going third is that you find you agree largely with the other people. So let's imagine that that in 2071, in this very room, there's a conference to celebrate. This is the Bob Room, but maybe change something. There's a conference to celebrate 50 years since what is now generally accepted to be the successful formulation of a theory that unifies quantum theory and general relativity. So, in other words, let's imagine that in 2021, someone finally comes up with such a theory. I chose the year 2021 for two reasons. First of all, it's about halfway between 100 years since the development of GR on the one hand and quantum theory on the other hand. The first reason, and the second reason, that it's not too far in the future, but also not too soon, that each of us might imagine we could be that person who's going to come up with this theory, or that belong to that group of people. So we return to this conference, 2071, in this very room, and this old guy stands up at the front, leaning on his walking stick, and he says, oh yeah, 2021, I remember it well, I was there. Here is how it happened. So my question is, what is he going to say? In particular, will he say, well, it was this extremely clever, you know, mathematician, he had these ideas, and he came up with a theory, and, you know, there's a just noticed a long paper here by a very smart mathematician called Kevin Costello, who he came up with a theory, and he really wasn't very concerned about foundational questions at all. He just invented this theory. And then if you push this old guy, he might say, well, yeah, no, I remember there were a whole bunch of people who were worried about the foundations of quantum theory. Interesting, but they really had no impact whatsoever on the development of this new theory of quantum gravity, which in any case actually has a very obvious interpretation, and you know it's interesting. Of course, meanwhile, this group of people who had been working on quantum foundations may have come up with the perfect interpretation of quantum theory, and that would be a historical curiosity since it would have no bearing at all on the new amazing theory that comes up in the future. So that's one thing that could happen. The other thing that could happen, and what I'm really hoping for, is this old guy could say, yes, well, it turns out that the questions these guys were asking in this curious little field, the foundations of quantum theory, were absolutely pivotal. Without them asking these questions, we never would have gotten to a theory of quantum gravity. In fact, the theory of quantum gravity was developed by this very community. That would be great, but how on earth are we likely to do that? To some extent, I agree with Bill. You know, we worry a lot about foundation, these conceptual questions, and I think we should think about them. But we should also think about how to make progress in this big, important question: theory of quantum, how to develop a theory of quantum gravity. So my hope is that people in this field, because I really believe that this sort of foundational way of thinking is the right way to do physics, but we can fall into a trap of being complacent, of not actually practicing physics in such a way that we're likely to make progress. It's fine to debate conceptual questions, but we also have to be involved in the business of actually constructing new theories that have a chance of being correct, and new physical theories of the world. We have to be engaged in that plan at some level. So this question, what is the, you know, the problem of, let's call it quantum gravity. Quantum gravity is really a placeholder at this stage for the theory that is going to unify general relativity and quantum theory, or maybe, you know, maybe be something even more spectacular than that, but some physical theory that's going to come along later. Well, the problem of quantum gravity is to find a theory which is potentially deeper than either general relativity or quantum theory, but which reduces inappropriate limits to general relativity on the one hand, in those experimental situations where you see the predictions of GR played out currently, and quantum theory on the other hand, in those situations where you see the predictions of quantum theory played out. But it might be a much deeper theory, so it may use a much deeper very different kind of mathematics to the sort of mathematics we see currently in either general relativity or quantum theory, just as general relativity uses a very different kind of mathematics to the general relativity that we see in Newtonian physics. We have to imagine that that may happen. So what about this conference? What does the sort of landscape of quantum theory, this landscape idea, have to do with general relativity? Well, it seems to me there are two things that this point of view might motivate us to do in terms of coming to a theory of quantum gravity. The first thing is that we should seek a framework that is hospitable to a theory of quantum gravity. And the second thing we should do is find some principles that we can apply in that framework that may narrow us down to an actual theory. So a framework we sort of corresponds to a set of theories. We want to find the particular correct physical theory within that framework. Let me just address those two different points. So first of all, a framework that is hospitable to a theory of quantum gravity. Well, how do we know we have a framework that is sort of general enough, hopefully not too general, to be hospitable in this way? Well, let's look at the two less fundamental theories, general relativity on the one hand and quantum theory on the other hand, and ask what properties those theories have that might have to be represented in the new physical theory, the deeper theory. Well, if you look at GR and quantum theory, they're both conservative and radical in sort of complementary respects. General relativity is conservative in that it is, in some sense, a deterministic theory, but it's radical in that the causal structure in that theory is dynamical. It's a thing you actually solve for. And, you know, Einstein's field equations are remarkable in that they are local equations for this quantity g mu nu, where what you mean by locality is actually expressed with respect to g mu nu. In other words, you have local equations that are local with respect to the quantity that you're solving for. Very remarkable equations, and this notion of locality or causality that's built into the metric is something that isn't fixed in advance, but you solve for that using those equations. Quantum theory is radical and conservative, like I said, in the opposite respect. It's conservative in that it works on a fixed background causal structure. In the simplest case, you simply evolve a wave function in time. So your time structure is in some sense trivial. Or if you think about quantum circuits, well, you have a fixed quantum circuit and you evolve your state through that circuit. Or various different applications of quantum theory, you always have a fixed background. It's radical in that it has probabilities built in a sort of intrinsic fashion. You can't really formulate standard quantum theory without reference to probabilities. And so there's this inherent probabilism that is brought into the picture. So it seems to me that in a deeper theory, you will have to have the two radical features survive. It's conceivable that actually a deeper theory will be in accordance with the two conservative features. It will be both deterministic and have fixed causal structure in the background, but that just seems to me to be unlikely. It seems much more likely that the deeper theory is going to be is going to have both dynamical causal structure and have and be intrinsically probabilistic. In fact, it probably will be a bit worse than that even. If you look at general relativity, after you've solved the equations, you do at least have a definite fixed, a definite causal structure. Even if you didn't know what that causal structure was in advance of solving the equations, once you've got an expression for g mu nu everywhere, then you know what the causal structure is. On the other hand, in quantum theory, any quantity which is subject to variation, like which hole in a two-slit experiment the particle goes through, is also subject to superposition. So you have something like no matter of the fact as to whether the particle went through the hole on the left or the hole on the right. And so in the context of quantum gravity, you might expect something like no matter of the fact as to whether the causal structure was this or that. In other words, you have you would expect indefinite causal structure. It seems to me that this issue of indefinite causal structure, the fact that you are likely to have indefinite causal structure in a theory of quantum gravity, is absolutely key and conceptually very demanding. It's demanding because most of our physical theories seem to assume that we have some sort of definite causal structure in the background. Certainly, if you imagine evolving a quantum state in time, then you need something like a foliation into space-like hypersurfaces. And you can't have a space-like hypersurface if the causal structure is indefinite because you don't know whether two points are separated by a space-like or a time-like interval. So it seems to me that the framework that we are seeking must at least accommodate the possibility of indefinite causal structure, and also it has to be probabilistic. So those two things, indefinite causal structure, and it must admit probabilities. So that's I've done some work on sort of writing down some preliminary framework that had those features. It's a long way from being sufficient, I think, for the purpose at hand. But I think that's kind of essential. So that's the first point I want to make. We need a framework that's sufficiently general that it can admit it might admit a theory of quantum gravity. How much time do I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, good. And then the second thing is, once we've got that general framework, incidentally, that's a bit like it's a bit analogous to you know the situation during the development of general relativity, where it was necessary to have this sort of general framework of of Riemannian geometry and so forth. And then within that framework, you could single out the actual correct theory of general relativity. So we need something similar for the case of quantum gravity. So furthermore, I think that this sort of foundational way of thinking, this conceptual way of thinking, is likely. It's possible that will be a way of inventing such a framework. And then the second thing we need is we need some principles, some ideas that may restrict us down within that general framework to the correct theory of quantum gravity. So there, my hope is that at least coming from the quantum side, some of these axioms and ideas that we've discussed, Marcus and Howard and also Alex discussed in these reconstructions of quantum theory, my hope is that some of those ideas may pass over and become good principles which you can use to narrow yourself down to the correct theory of quantum gravity. My current favorite principle is something which I think is a bit deeper than the axioms that appear in those frameworks. I call it the composition principle. So here's the idea of the composition principle. So in physical theories, generally, you have sort of bigger systems that are made after smaller systems. So you may have a table that's made out of a table top and four table legs. Or you may have a region of space-time that you can think of as being composed out of out of smaller regions of space-time, and these are attached together in some particular way. And you can write down the in some sort of abstract notation how a particular object is composed, how the bigger object is built out of the smaller objects. So this is a sort of this is a sort of language for describing composite objects in the abstract. The composition principle says, roughly speaking, that the equations you have for predicting things about that that physical object should take the same form. The expression should look the same. Okay, so if you describe the composition of a certain object in a certain way, then the expression for calculating the properties of that object should look the same. And you can make this idea play out in quantum theory. So in quantum theory, if you have a circuit, you can describe the circuit with a picture. And interestingly, you can write down the equation for the probability for that circuit by a picture that looks identical. You know, it's possible to write down equations using pictures. So it seems that this kind of principle might be very deep, and it's the kind of principle that might be useful in a theory where you have indefinite causal structure. So that's my current favorite principle. So just to finish, my real message is that I think this way of thinking that we've been developing in the field of quantum foundations over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years is potentially very powerful and could have a real impact on the future of physics. And the only thing we need to do to make that happen is to have the right attitude and really try to take on this problem of quantum gravity. We are, in a sense, very lucky to live in a time when this sort of juicy problem is just sitting there open for us to, you know, it's a sort of a beautiful problem, just trying to unify two different theories. It has all the hallmarks of the kind of problem that is interesting to people who are interested in conceptual issues. So I'm very ambitious for this sort of landscape type program and quantum foundations in general.
Thanks. So Lucian had the problem that he agreed with what all the previous speakers said. I have the problem that Lucian gave my talk.
That's why I sat here.
So I'll say something slightly different then. Actually, it was a little bit more like an introduction to causal sets than quite the thing I was going to say today. I don't know if you would agree. But so let me start by asking, why are we looking, a question that's come up many times now, why are we looking for alternatives to quantum theory or generalizations of quantum theory? And I can think of three reasons. One, well, just for the hell of it, that is, or to say it in a more sophisticated way, we're looking to populate this landscape, situate quantum mechanics within it, and so on, in a way that's been mentioned. Second reason, of course, which is probably the primary one for many people here, is we're looking to resolve some of the philosophical problems that affect the interpretation of the quantum formalism as we have it. And then the third reason, which is the deepest reason for me, and that Lucian really did express everything I would have said, is of course we're looking to do something for the need as a service to the problem of quantum gravity. Because we may believe, as I do, that the two problems are intertwined, the problems of quantum gravity and quantum foundations. So having said that, let me just make interpolate a comment that even if you're just interested in relativistic quantum field theory in curved space and not yet even quantum gravity, the textbook interpretation, sometimes called Copenhagen, of the theory already fails. And that was something that Daniel referred to earlier. Specifically, what fails is that if you assume that every operator defined in a region of space-time can be the subject of an ideal projective measurement confined to that region, then you can signal faster than light. So that cannot be true, but then the question is what things can be measurable and what are the rules for reduction and collapse and so on. So having said this, it doesn't necessarily mean that quantum field theory is wrong in any deep sense. On the other hand, it is true that the standard model is almost certainly a wrong and inconsistent theory. The only thing is that the inconsistencies that are known that go by names of Landau-Pohl, those inconsistencies generally refer to length scales much shorter than the Planck length, or energies much higher than the Planck energy, and they may be indicating to us, if they're not indicating that we just need to find a better quantum field theory, they're indicating that we need to resolve quantum gravity before we can really have the standard model and put into a consistent framework. So I want to mention two directions of possible modification or generalization of quantum theory. The first one has also been Marcus referred to, and I think Howard and Alex too, I think, which is higher order interference, the possibility of higher order interference. This is something on which very little work has been done, actually, although there was an experiment to put bounds on it. And the second one is what I call quantum measure theory, which is just a generalized version of the path integral on which there's been a lot of work and on which I think we'll hear something tomorrow from Joe and Petros. So in both of these, both of these directions of generalization have in common that we think of quantum dynamics as a kind of generalized probability calculus, which is also very much, I think, harmonious with what people have said. But I think that they may mean that probability is still what it always was, and I mean something slightly different, that probability actually has a generalized meaning. So let me say something about first higher order interference and then quantum measure theory mainly. So higher order interference comes from a way of thinking about quantum mechanics. What is it that makes quantum mechanics different from classical mechanics? Maybe probability, but many people have thought, despite some of the talks here, which I think specifically denied it, I'm trying to remember which one it was, that interference wasn't the key thing. I'm still kind of persuaded that interference is the key to the difference between quantum and classical. So what do I mean by interference, thought of in terms of a probability measure or a generalized probability measure? Given two disjoint events, two disjoint sets of histories, like the particle going through the left slit or the particle going through the right slit, in a classical theory, the probability of the union of those two is just the probability, the sum of the probabilities of the individual ones minus the probability of the empty set. I only said the probability of the empty set is zero for us theorists, but I found out when this experiment was being done that it's not zero in the lab. It's called dark counts. So you have to include it actually in the equation. But that's no interference. Interference, as in the famous example of the two-slit experiment, means that this equality is not true, but quantum mechanics nevertheless respects a slightly different inequality, which expresses the fact that interference is only pairwise and not some whatever the threefold analog of pairwise is. And as an equation on this generalized probability measure, it says that if you have three mutually disjoint events or sets of histories, then the measure, I won't call it probability now, the measure of the union is the sum of the measures of all the pairs minus the measures of all the singlets plus the measure of the empty set. Okay, and quantum mechanics satisfies this, but these rules live in a hierarchy. Each one implies the next, and one could imagine going farther in the hierarchy, and I think Lucien also referred to it briefly in a comment earlier, because in his original axioms, that possibility of a very analogous hierarchy came out automatically. Quantum mechanics resides at level two of this hierarchy. We could imagine going higher, and only a little bit of work has been done on that. Maybe someone can remind me of other, but there was some work by Karl Zichkovsky. I think Howard and to some extent, thought about it. Joe Emerson and some of the IQPC QC people, maybe Thomas Jenwein, and notably David Meyer thought about it to the extent that he concluded that a post-quantum computer, operating at level 3 would be able to be exponentially faster than the quantum computer in the same way a quantum computer could be, hopefully, exponentially faster than a classical one. So I can't say much more about that level 3 possibility, this hierarchy, because very little work has been done, but I can say quite a lot about quantum measure theory, which is a much less radical departure than such a level 3 or higher theory would be. In fact, it's questionable whether it's a departure from quantum mechanics at all. But to introduce it, let me say that the sum rule that I just told you that quantum mechanics satisfies leads directly to the existence of a decoherence functional, which we saw in Bill's talk an example of in the context of quantum field theory. This, more generally, one can think of a decoherence functional as a kind of generalized path integral. And in talking about it in a histories-based way, the basic concepts are indeed histories and events. And I think we'll hear more about the actual structure of that theory tomorrow from Joe and Petros. But why would you want specifically to formulate quantum mechanics in this way or to generalize it in this way if it's a generalization? That, of course, is because of quantum gravity. Quantum gravity, well, it's not the only reason, but that would be my main reason. Quantum gravity faces two particular problems. One is the problem of infinities or divergences, and the other is the so-called problem of time, which arises when you try to treat quantum gravity in a canonical framework. The first problem has suggested long ago, even before people started thinking about quantum gravity, that the real solution is a fundamental spatial-temporal discreteness, and that, of course, leads in particular to the causal set program. But discreteness, if you accept it, also tells you that you really can't hope to have a Hamiltonian formulation of your theory. A Hamiltonian is something that evolves you in an infinitesimal amount in time, and that's just not there. What that leaves in formulations of quantum mechanics is the path integral. So you should try to do quantum mechanics with the path integral and ultimately nothing else. The other problem also points in the direction of a histories-based, or which is my word for a generalized path integral, a histories-based formulation of quantum mechanics, because if you have a histories-based in the context of quantum gravity means space-time-based, your fundamental object of interest, your history, is a space-time or some generalization of it, like a causal set. When you have that, you don't need to recover time. The canonical quantization loses time. It sort of slips between your fingers, and then you have to work very hard to get it back. That's called the problem of time. In my own opinion, it's insoluble within that framework. So those are there's also some issues related to non-unitarity, which Bill alluded to, but I won't talk about them now. So to summarize, I think what we need is a freestanding, histories-based formulation of quantum mechanics. So think, for example, of Adrian's talk. If you ask, what does that mean? You might think of Adrian's talk, in which, unless I missed it, which I might have, he never mentioned the wave function. In any case, he hardly needed to mention the wave function. And that also means, for example, that a lot of questions that you might have worried about may not be so serious questions like, is it ontic or epistemic? So I've sort of outlined for you what is quantum measure theory. It's a generalized theory of probability that's supposed to give the dynamics of quantum mechanics. Let me finish by asking, is it really a generalization or a modification of quantum mechanics or not? So I would say that all depends on what you think the essence of quantum mechanics is. If you think the essence of quantum mechanics is Hilbert space, a wave function, an expectation value, sandwiching operators between wave functions, then a histories-based formulation like I'm referring to might seem a very radical modification, although not as radical as going to third-order interference, for example. On the other hand, if you thought of quantum mechanics all along in terms of the path integral, this would hardly seem a modification at all. Indeed, even things that seemed radical, like collapse models, when you think in terms of the wave function, from a history's point of view, seem like small tinkerings that don't necessarily make any essential difference to the story. However, having said that in some sense it's not radical and quite conservative, I should mention that it seems that maybe at least in small ways it does go beyond ordinary quantum mechanics in providing for the kind of bipartite correlations that ordinary quantum mechanics does not allow for. And I think that will be, I think Joe is going to say something about that in his talk. And then just maybe it also provides a basis for a new kinematics, as I would say, or ontology, as people tend to say in philosophy, for quantum theory itself, even in non-relativistic quantum theory. And I think Petros will have something to say about that in his talk.
Thank you, Raphael. In the dire situation that there seems to be a threat of peace breaking out among the panelists.
I can remedy if you really want.
Did anyone want to jump in and say something?
So I could comment on sort of histories versus compositional approach. So maybe it's not the dichotomy that people often talk about. So certainly the usual standard quantum theory works with a wave function that evolves in time. And then people such as yourself say, well, in quantum gravity, that breaks down, so we have to go to a histories approach. But there's also the option of what I would call a compositional approach. So applied to space-time, the idea is that you take some bigger region of space-time and you regard it as being composed of lots of smaller regions of space-time, which can be arbitrarily shaped as long as they fit together. And then you try to set your physics up in such a way that, really what physics does very well is if you have a description of small things, which tend to be simpler, and you say how the small things are put together, then you can make more complicated things. So this compositional approach, first of all, you can formulate quantum theory in these terms. So it's a different way of formulating quantum theory without reference to a wave function that evolves in time. But also it's not a historicist formulation in the usual sense. And the criticism I would have of the history formulation is that you have to give these histories apply to all of your space-time region, the whole region that you're considering, that you sort of miss out on this interesting compositional structure that could play a deep role in this. And so it seems to me that sort of generalizations of quantum theory or frameworks for quantum gravity ought to take this approach instead.
Should I answer okay, let's go.
We should move on to the others and then let perhaps in the discussion you'll have a chance to say.
Now I just wanted to say a little bit more about higher order interference since Raphael brought it up. So one thing is that one of the axioms I mentioned in this work with Marcus and Cosman, the axiom that these filters or compressions or whatever you want to call them onto the faces of the state space preserve purity, in the context of our other two axioms, you can drop that and replace it with no higher order interference. And that's another way of deriving these Jordan type theories. So there is an instance where it does play a role in narrowing you down to quantum theory, as is not too or close to quantum theory. So that's maybe not so surprising. And I guess that's about all I want to say about that for now.
I wanted to say, I don't know if Marcus wants to say anything. I wanted to say something in response to Marcus, which was, you highlighted you called them fine-tuning problems, and one of them I think is a very deep and sort of underrated, or let's say under-addressed problem. The other one I'm not convinced is a real problem, so I'll talk about the first one, which was the problem of why is quantum mechanics have no signaling, right? And so I would push that farther and ask the question, what do you mean by no signaling, right? It's usually addressed in a kind of operational context where it has a definite meaning. But if you think in terms of quantum gravity and quantum cosmology especially, then an operational approach doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. You need an intrinsic approach to the theory, which I was at a recent conference, quantum mechanics without observers. That's what I mean by intrinsic, if you like. It doesn't presuppose the idea of observers. And so combining my two pet things, causality and histories-based formulations, I think it's a very interesting question. Even in the formalism or in the structure of the theory itself, how do you actually express the fact that it's not signaling? Or how do you express the fact that it respects some form of relativistic causality? What is it that you could point to in the past integral that, you know, that encodes that? That if we could really understand that, maybe that would be one of the clues that we're looking for when we come to quantum gravity.
So just as an answer to that, I would say that even if you have a theory like that for the whole universe, which disposes of the notion of an observer, it should still be able to reproduce the operational point of view as a special case. You say, yes. Now I want to specifically look at that situation where I do have an observer, and then you can still ask the same question, then you can still ask, why is it the case that the theory I have, restricted to the special case, does have this nice property? And so then you're just back to the same question.
Yes, you could ask the question, but I'm asking for the answer to that. And hopefully the answer would not refer directly to observers anymore, but to some properties of the amplitudes that go into the path integral.
Right.
Bill?
Yeah. Just a couple of brief comments. One is that whatever happens by 2071, I think we're going to be completely surprised. If we look through our history, the changes that were wrought in physics in all of the big changes produced something that was weirder and stranger than anything that anybody before that had ever really imagined could be possible. I mean, I don't think any of them came about because of, you know, let us look into the structure and foundations of what we have already, but came because they were baffling many times observations, in Einstein's case, just even logical inconsistencies, and they were incredibly pragmatic and incredibly unprincipled. I mean, they were willing to steal ideas from anywhere, combine things that had absolutely no reason to be combined with each other, just trying to battle their way through these problems, and producing theories as a result that, I mean, still bother us. you know, even though they work extremely well. And I don't think, you know, one of the things that you constantly see is people almost saying that if only we had, for example, quantum gravity, it would solve the problem of the singularities in general relativity. It may well solve the problem of singularities, but in such a way that everybody is going to look at it and say, boy, I wish we had singularities still.
What was the second?
Pardon?
I thought you had two things.
No.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, I agree that we are going to be very surprised in 2071, especially if we get there. But the second, this issue of non-signaling, I would like to understand exactly what we mean in the following sense. In what sense do you think a Raphael example is excluded in quantum theory? Because it doesn't seem to be excluded, right? And that's a very concrete example in which you get signaling by applying the quantum postulates that include every Hermitian operator is unobservable. So how do we exclude that possibility?
So what do you mean by example of signaling?
So I don't know if you know this example. It's an example in which you have 3 regions of space-time. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Rafael should explain it because it's your work.
I could say something about it. I should hasten to say before I do, it's not an example of signaling in which you could make a model of an observer who would necessarily be able to signal. It's probably to be interpreted as a limitation, a fundamental limitation of what an observer can actually do. But what we lack is
an understanding of what that limitation is in general. So let me just take
you probably lots of Russian little shop.
So it's just consider three regions of space time. It's best expressed in the algebraic formulation of quantum field theory, in which, similar to the one Bill sketched in his talk, in which you have field operators living at every point, and then within these three regions, which I'll call A, B, and C, we can define operators, which are just combinations of the field operators in that region. And then there's three operators, I don't know what to call them, so OA, OB, and OC. Actually, someone may remember my example better than I do, so correct me about what I'm about to say. But now you give yourself the assumption that this operator OB, let's call it OB hat, or an operator, that it can be measured by an ideal measurement, the kind that a projective measurement that collapses the wave function in a standard way, by operations carried out within the region in which it's defined. That seems like the most straightforward generalization of the non-relativistic assumptions. In fact, I know of no other coherent generalization. But if you imagine that, you see this could be very space-like, and it could be the case, and then you might worry, well, can I really make measurements of arbitrarily extended regions, spatially extended, when I don't have the time to communicate between one part and the other? That's the root of the paradox. Mm-hmm. It can happen that this region A is to the past of part of B, and this region C is to the past future of parts of B, and yet A and C are space-like to each other. And now if you imagine, either make a measurement, you take some simple state like vacuum or something, I don't remember. You make some sort of measurement here, maybe, or you just do something else, you fill it with the Hamiltonian, that fixes the system a little bit in this region. Then you make the measurement, you agree in advance with your friends that they'll make the measurement here, specific measurement, projection operator, the projection. And then you find that the result, and then this person at C makes whatever, they measure something, and you find that the statistic for what they measure is affected by whether you did or did not make the measurements here, or whether you did or did not pick the system, I forget exactly what. Yeah. Given that you know that given that this person knows that B made the measurement, B is in effect able to transmit information from A to C faster than light. So the reaction will be, well, you can't make this measurement. I should also mention that it's a very nice example. Preskill, Dan Gottesman, and I forget who the other author was, related this, I think in my example, it was a projection operator onto a combination of superposition of the vacuum and one part of the state, or something like that. But they have an example where they showed that you, with the same ground rules, you can't even measure a Wilson loop, spatial Wilson loop. A Wilson loop is kind of the fundamental observable of non-linear case series. That's even more dramatic.
So my point is that this claim that the theory is somehow geared to avoid signaling doesn't seem to hold if we take the theory as it stands. I mean, if you take the textbook theory, it says, system is a Hilbert space, states, you project using the Born rule when you measure, then you get signaling. So we need to change the theory.
So my answer here would be that just the way that quantum field theory is formulated is not very operational. I mean, we all agree that we will not be able to build this detector that does this measurement. So we need an addition to work out what the possible detectors are.
But that should in some sense be forbidden in principle by the theory, not by your hard time coming up with the thesis. If it's not forbidden in principle by the theory, then I wouldn't say that the theory is really geared out.
Well, I think if you really work out how the detector works in the form of this more quantum field theory, then you will, in the end, find out that restriction that you cannot build this detector. So I'm just saying that things could be much worse. So you could have a theory where just a two-level system over here, a two-level system over there, could actually allow you to signal. And then you wouldn't even have to go to the field of like the infinite degrees of freedom. Could make it much easier. And the fact that you have to at least go to infinite dimensions and to all these.
But that doesn't depend on being infinite dimensional, right?
No, not really. In fact, I think
you got an example. There's
there's examples in analogous and quantum games that are close or analogs of this composite system.
It does depend on the amplitude.
It does depend on
the
amplitude. Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Okay. So I should say one other thing. If someone were, if the whole world was described by quantum field theory in a fixed causal structure, most people would probably say, well, we know what it is about this theory that blocks this, although I don't think they would be able to prove it very well. But we know what it is. It's based on the commutativity of the field operators and the hyperbolic nature of the field equations. But if you...
That blocks everything being measurable?
It must block. Yeah. What it blocks is having any two. It blocks two space like separated agents, external agents, being able to manipulate the system in such a way as to send information from one to the other. So presumably, therefore, it must block its measure. But I have no idea, as Danielle was saying.
A could send a qubit to B, and the other, you know, B's friend on the other part could send a qubit to C, and they could have an entangled pair, and they could do a teleportation thing, and they would be doing a joint measurement that's not separable, okay, that could be part of their device. And yet you still wouldn't get signaling, and the reason is that B can't control which outcome they get. And so the way it's been specified, it kind of sounds like, well, B can control that, but that's, you wouldn't get signaling in that.
It's just the fact that
he
does
measure.
That's
right.
It's independent of what
he
obtains.
So B gets 0 or 1 when you project, and you're averaging.
But well, I'm just giving you an example where B does a joint measurement or doesn't, and you know, A sends a system to B, and B sends one to C, and B either does or doesn't do a joint measurement, and you don't get signaling in the non-relativistic case. So the scenario as drawn does not a priori necessitate signaling.
No, you
would have to give me a specific set of operators and
That's what he did.
I don't believe that there's a version using, you know, finite dimensional systems sent from A to B and some projective measurements.
There are simple cases. I mean, years and years ago.
But what I mean by constructively, in the sense that B, who has to do a joint measurement on these space-like separated things, might use some entanglement and so on, but can't just, you know, by fiat use a non-product projective measurement across the whole of B, because no one who's doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics would think that. Then I can do signaling by just take an S1 dot S2 Hamiltonian, put the spins a light year away, and turn this spin in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that would give you signaling because you don't have a retarded potential. You know, there is always some kind of tension between the signaling in non-relativistic and some non-signaling, but I don't think that this is.
I think David was about to say something wrong, there's been a discussion about what kind of operators on, say, joint system are measurable by local operations and which ones aren't, right? And
I take a very trivial example. You have two boxes, okay? And there's a so let's see how to do this. So you consider a four-dimensional Hilbert space of these two boxes. Two of the states are, here's a basis of the four-dimensional space. No particle in either box, a particle in box one, a particle in box two, a particle in each box, okay? And you allow yourself to make a measurement that distinguishes between particle in box one plus particle in box two and particle in box one minus particle in box two, okay? And then, and when you make that measurement, if there's no particle in either box, you definitely get that result, and if there are two particles, you definitely get that result. Good. Let the guy in A choose to put a particle in box one or not to put a particle in box one. Then the guy in B instantaneously does this measurement. Then the guy in C looks in box two. The probability of finding anything in box two will be zero if A didn't put the particle in box two. You've got signal, I mean, they're very simple.
That's exactly, that's a good example. You can't, a projective measurement across a space like separated region is...
But we're talking non-relativistically here.
Right, so, but then you don't, I'm saying, if you're just going to do that, you might as well just take S1 dot S2 interaction between two spins and grab spin one and turn it.
Here's the surprise. Here's the surprise. The surprise turned out to be there are certain genuinely non-local measurements that you can do with purely local interactions. Yakir invented this very clever trick of preparing two measuring devices in an entangled superposition, okay? Then you read the measuring devices after the two interactions. You don't get any information about region one from looking at measuring device number one. You don't get any information about region two from looking at measuring device number two, but you get information about the joint region by looking at the sum of what the two measuring devices do or something like that. So there's a whole class of measurements of genuinely non-local observables that you can do with local interactions. The one I described is not among them.
And give B some entanglement and let them do their measurements. It looks
right.
Like a joint observable, but in the non-relativistic case, there is no tension with signaling. I don't understand the relativistic case well enough.
Here's the nature of the tension. It's perfectly clear in the non-relativistic case. You want to know if you can do signaling between regions which have no Hamiltonian interaction with one another. That's the question. That's the analog of space-like separation in the non-relativistic case. Okay? You want to know if you can, by doing something here, get a signal to something over there in the complete absence of any term in the Hamiltonian that links those two regions of space-time. Okay? Good. The answer to that is so the answer to that turns out to be complicated. The answer to that, of course, turns out to be no. Okay, you can't do it. But it's not because you can't, with local interactions, measure any genuinely non-local observables in this sense of non-local that I'm talking about now. You can, okay? But there are restrictions on the ones you can measure locally that make it impossible that you could do signaling between two such regions that are, you might say, dynamically
this
separated
is,
rather than...
But all I'm saying is in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that the measurement theory, let's say, is just clear-cut. I don't think I could even set up a good paradox for it. Whereas in the relativistic case, I agree. I mean, I think there is a lot of issues about the sort of quantum field theory of measurement, which we haven't answered.
I don't think anyone's saying anything different.
That's pretty clear. You might naively think in quantum field theory that any projection operator associated with region P counts as a good observable and measurable. But just as in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there are if you've got an extended system, there are observables associated with which are not.
There are Hermitian operators.
Hermitian operators which are not measurable by a local operator.
Or rather, more generally, there's a question of which operators are Hermitian or not. And then there's a question of what the structure of the actual Hamiltonian of the world is, and which kinds of measurement style couplings that allows. Okay. And of course, the second class is much bigger than the first class. Mm-hmm.
This is an example of one that is measurable. I think if you would narrow this down to a single hypersurface, which doesn't really make sense in quantum field theory, but if you did it, and your observable, your Hermitian operator was the integral of a local scalar, then that would not get into trouble with this. So some people began to explore a little bit what is the range of.
In fact, if you look at things like Hobbes' book on quantum field theory, he says the observables are the ones that are equal to local scalars.
He does?
Yeah. There's something of that flavor. There's a restriction to observable being things constructed in certain ways out of the fields.
I mean, there's a chance that, string theory or something comes along that's a regular quantum theory and that gives us the quantum theory of gravity. And would you still think that working in foundations was a useful endeavor? Like, I work in foundations almost independent of, I mean, I hope or feel that, yeah, like these guys said, that there would be an impact, but...
If string theory...
Well, just some of regular quantum theory.
It's hard to answer that. It's very hard to answer that because string theory it lacks at present what they call a background independent formulation. And that means you can't even address these big questions.
Well, I'm saying
but
is that it's a regular quantum
instruction. Let me just imagine,
and
try to answer your question in that,
yeah.
in that context. One of the versions of string theory, one of the hopes for that background independent formulation is via this ADS-CFT correspondence. What that really means is something that I like to say that string theory is the longest and most painful road from flat space back to flat space. And the reason I'm adapting a joke that Karl Kukoc told once. The reason is that the CFT theory is actually a flat space quantum field theory. There's no gravity in it at all. There's a fixed causal structure, the whole space-time is background. Depending on their point of view, all you have in the end is some sort of S matrix in that, scattering processes in that S3 cross R. So it's just a large sphere cross time, with time engineering trivially. If that turned out to be the right theory of quantum gravity,
is it worth doing foundations?
I would never say it's. I think it's very worth doing foundation, I would probably still wonder about it myself in any case. But I would have to admit that my burning interest in it would diminish quite a lot in that situation.
I think my interest would shift much more. How the hell can a flat space theory and S3 cross R talk about the interior of a black hole? Something like that.
It seems striking to me that in setting up, neither in setting up string theory nor in setting up the sort of canonical approach to quantum gravity, to the people in those fields that think very deeply about this issue of indefinite causal structure. It seems that very, and you ask people in those fields, they say you would expect something like this, and yet it's not involved in setting up the sort of frameworks that they deal with. Raphael's approach does take this into account. I think you have sort of at least some probabilistic mixture of different causal sets. But generally, most approaches to quantum gravity that don't seem to do that. And I find that quite odd. It seems to be basic approach.
So I'm basically just a word about the signaling. If we're talking about causal structure and so forth emerging, I wonder if no signaling might sort of get built into things
by definition. That might be part of how you construct a causal structure.
Right. That's always the temptation to believe something like that. But
<Uh-oh>.
I mean, unfortunately, it depends what you mean by the causal structure. But we could take an example of classical relativity, or classical gravity. And there we have a curved space-time, and as Lucian was saying, a dynamical, in a certain sense, a dynamical causal structure. And in the theories we actually write down, the causal structure is that given by the metric. But unfortunately, it's all too easy to write down other field theories, which are perfectly generally covariant, Lorentz invariant, and everything, in whatever sense people have been able to come up with, in which you do have propagation faster than light. So, in the extreme case, if it's the extreme case, Niyayash Afshardi here, for example, is in thinking about the cosmological constant problem, he's made a theory in which you have infinitely fast signaling, basically. It's kind of an ether, a sort of Newtonian-type ether. We can argue... The person's name?
Yeah.
Niyayash Afshardi. He's a sort of cosmologist here. The point is you can get signaling, like you can put a fluid and you can make the relation between pressure and
So it's like
and
saying
density in the fluid be such that the speed of sound is faster than light. And in fact, people use those causal relationships as principles that would like Lucien was saying, would narrow down the class of fluid theories that you can reasonably write down in space-time. So I think the situation, there's two causal notions. There's a notion of what you might call temporality, which is the light cone structure of space-time, and then there's the dynamical notion of causality. Do the actual phenomena or the physical processes, do they respect this causal structure, this kinematical causal structure? And it's not, in general, the answer is no. You need to say something further about the dynamics.
In this sort of operational approach to quantum theory, where you think of your quantum system as systems passing between boxes, and your boxes have knobs on that you can adjust.
So you have both of those aspects of causality coming in. So you have the wiring between the boxes defines a sort of background fixed causal structure, and all this sort of approaches have that in them. And then you have what I call the Pauli causality axiom, which says that there exists a unique deterministic effect. What that means is that if you ignore what happens in the future of a certain sort of space-like hypersurface in your circuit, you ignore the outcomes on the boxes in the future, then the probability for the bit in the past is unchanged. It's the same. So change in the knob settings in the future doesn't affect the knob settings in the past. And so if you think of the future, or part of the circuit in the future, as sort of being some effect that you put on your system, some measurement. And if it's a deterministic effect, so you don't look at the outcomes, then the statement I just made, the deterministic effect is unique, is equivalent to saying that you can't signal from the future into the past with respect to the causal structures defined by the wires. So one of the challenges for my program, which is sort of more operational approach to quantum gravity, is that you lose this definite causal structure in the background. You can't have these sort of wires. The connections between the boxes can't necessarily correspond to your underlying causal structure. But that Pauli causality principle that I mentioned needs that in order to so that you can state it. And that Pauli causality principle really narrows down the set of allowed mathematical objects that can correspond to the operations on these boxes. So once you throw out the definite causal, the fixed background causal structure, you throw out the possibility of a sort of a Pauli causality principle that is stated currently. And so there's a problem there. I mean, the other thing that this sort of signaling, this Pauli causality principle brings up is the role of agency. So if somebody makes a choice, so within the operational framework, you can imagine somebody does this or that, and then what you mean by no signaling is that there should be no influence from that choice on this box to boxes that are not connected by forward-pointing wires. But that gives the notion of agency a very deep and fundamental role, which is problematic if you want to take the point of view that quantum theory should be formulated at its deepest level without observers. My current attitude to that problem is to wait and see. It seems like a very powerful principle, but I don't know if it can be a fundamental principle.
Maybe I should just mention that problem you just referred to, that the Pauli causality principle has no clear formulation when you allow these wires to vary. We're actually facing exactly that problem in quantum sets. I won't try to go into why, give the technical reason why, but if we knew how to get around that, we would have an important clue to how to formulate a certain dynamical law for the quantum sets.
So this is cool. This is a joke, but formulating a locality, a causality principle in the context of causal sets.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. We know how to do it classically. We know what the analog of Bell causality or whatever you call that is classically.
Yep.
But there is more like relativity. You have only one causal set, you don't have a superposition. It's dynamically evolving causal structure, but it's not in some sense indefinite.
Why do you care about this causality principle if you don't have agents?
Well, just on the supposition, it's a guess, I suppose. It's a guess that that's one of the deepest facts about space-time or whatever it is that replaces space-time. But also, as a practical reason, that turned out to be a very fertile or fruitful kind of principle. You said we're looking for principles. Exactly as you said, we're looking for principles. But as Bill said, we can be opportunists. Even if we can't go back and dig into Plato or whatever, why we need this principle.
Right.
As long as it leads somewhere useful, then we'll be happy to take it, right? And in the classical case, it led to something very useful. So the hope would be that if we understand this quantum generalization, it'll lead us to something very useful. Came the quantum gravity in that case.
So in the panel presentations, I got the impression that the project of finding a theory of quantum gravity is almost presented as if it was based on the assumption that this is really the right path. But what if it isn't? What if there is somehow the world is such that you have a quantum description of one part of it and a classical description of that. Now, if you take that seriously, it seems to me that this would lead to a whole range of research questions you wouldn't have otherwise thought about. And just, I know almost nothing about what you just said about the indefinite causal structures, but it seems to me that just from a plausibility argument that maybe if you're not careful, that you could run into some contradictions, and then maybe if that was what you wanted to try to find out, if you were guided by that idea, that you would try to formulate some sort of a theorem about what is not possible, and then progressively restrict the range of possible ways in which you can have indefinite causal structures. Another question that otherwise it seems to me might not be thought of would be, if you assume this, then that means that their domains of duality have to be somehow mutually exclusive in some way that is not obvious to us at this point. And what could that be?
So you can imagine that you can work properly well with two different theories applied to different situations. So let's patch that up into a single theory in the following way. So we need, first of all, a theory that tells us, this particular experiment should be described by quantum theory, whereas this experiment should be described by general relativity. Two different relativities. So every time we encounter an experiment, we have to know which of those two theories to use. Other than that, it's perfectly fine to use one or the other. Well, that's a unified theory because I have to append to it this criteria that tells me whether a particular situation is. It's not a very nice unified theory, but it's a much better unified theory than anyone has at present. At least if it were empirically adequate in any conceivable experiment. On the other hand, one can think about experiments where that sort of theory might have problems. So in particular, if you can imagine experiments where a superposition of causal structures would come into play, then it's difficult to imagine that general relativity by itself or quantum theory by itself could deal with it.
Well, if you could experimentally test it, that would, it seems to me, already rule that out.
Of course, those experiments are very difficult. There's a sort of macroscopic superposition experiment that we talked about during the colloquium would be the place to go, perhaps.
Well, it seems that in those kinds of experiments, you would have to be able to also measure the associated gravity field. Did see that then, yes, quantum gravity has to be the answer, in that case, if you do.
There's another sort of argument due to Harrenhoff, at least one version of it. You imagine an interference with an electron, so the electron has a certain charge, and as it passes through the interferon, it comes out as interference. If you imagine slowly increasing the charge on the electron, at a certain point, the interference would have to disappear, because you could do a measurement, bring another charge into play after the electron would pass from the micrometer to detect which way the electron went. Then, according to standard quantum theory, the interference should be there. And the same also apply to the mass as well. Like, you take the mass of a small mass like an electron. Well, if the mass is below a certain some value, then you can't do this. But if it gets to be above that value, then in principle, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do a detect which way. So it seems like some sort of quantum gravitational effect has to come into a play to account for the transition between the situation where the mass doesn't matter and the situation where it does.
Maybe last question for the audience. Okay, I would like to ask for the unified theory similar to one you described, which we already have, except on one side is quantum mechanics, on the other side is general relativity, the one you just talked about. But how about the one where on one side is quantum mechanics, on the other side is classical mechanics? And we see, small-scale things, quantum works pretty well, large-scale things, classical works pretty well, and there is some sort of boundary, effective boundary. And I think there, well, at least I'm not clear how that boundary works. I think there are varying thoughts on how well that boundary is defined and controlled. Comment on that?
There's a problem of accounting for classical mechanics in the context of quantum theory, which is not something I've studied very much, but it's an important problem.
It's related to the last, I think the last two comments are actually in some way similar, because in fact some people have suspected that what makes the difference between macroscopic and microscopic, or where the interference cuts off, is where gravity is involved. It's a historical fact, I think, that Leon Rosenfeld may have been the first. In any case, he was a very strong advocate of the fact that one should not quantize gravity, that one should keep it classical. Then you have all the advantages of a fixed causal structure, and we wouldn't have to trouble ourselves allowing what's going on with superpositions of causal structure. The question then is, what is a consistent way of coupling a classical gravity, or classical causal set, as I would prefer, to quantum matter? And we have actually models of that, right? I mean, I always thought that's just impossible. It just doesn't make sense. How could you possibly couple a quantum? And I mentioned that to Umezawa once, and he said, oh no, it's easy, read my book, I'll tell you how. So I looked at his book, and I still couldn't quite figure out what it was, but now, what these collapse theories are, in a certain sense, is precisely a way of coupling. When you view them from a history's point of view, or in terms of a decoherence stuff, that's really what they are. They're theories in which you have two different kinds of trajectories, the ones that are kept classical and the ones that are allowed to be quantum. And they interact. And so any of these, the one that Phil told us about, or the one that Adrian sketched out for us, and there's also one by Faye Dauper and I guess Joe and Faye, which is a kind of field theory, a theoretic analog of this, one that Adrian talked about. All of those are precisely, when viewed in a certain way, that a coupling of the classical system, which from the decoherence functional point of view means one, means that the decoherence functional is diagonal on those trajectories, if that means anything to you. And yet it's not diagonal on the other degrees of freedom. So that is a coupling of the classical. So it's actually not been overlooked, but I think most people have felt, well, probably that it's just ugly. But maybe they should have given more, especially now that we have all these examples, doing that, maybe it should be given more attention. I think it's ugly too.
There are also problems with theories like that. I mean, way back when, this was very naive, I thought about published a paper which was supposed to be Why Study Quantum Gravity, and the journal published it as Why Study Quantum Mechanics. in which I looked at some of the problems of trying to couple a classical theory of gravity to a quantum theory of a matter, and there's a lot of difficulties that you run into, this inconsistencies, maybe not logical inconsistencies, but almost certainly experimental inconsistencies. Now, a lot of those experiments haven't directly been done, so I can't argue that we know that this doesn't work, but I think everybody would expect it not to work.
Yeah, and also, for example, you wouldn't have gravitons. Have we ever seen an individual graviton? No.
But you still have gravitational radiation.
You absolutely still have gravitational radiation. LIGO would not be
better. But the problem with that is that then you start, what happens is the gravitational radiation starts carrying away the commutational relations, so you would expect that the commutational relationships would gradually decay away, and the effective value of H bar would gradually change in various systems and different rates and different systems, depending on exactly how they couple to gravity. And all of those, one just doesn't believe it's what happens, but maybe that's why H bar is so small.
I think we need to wrap up soon, but Manuel, you have a quick comment?
Well, I think it depends how you take this theory, right? If you couple classical gravity at the semi-classical level with quantum matter, and you put collapse theories, that's the situation that Raphael says looks ugly. I don't think that at the experimental level it has been ruled out. At the fundamental, if you think of that as a fundamental theory, it's clearly inconsistent, because during a collapse, the equation could not hold. But if you look at this equation as an effective description, something analogous to the Navier-Stokes equations, which you know should hold most of the time while the liquid is behaving in its normal way, and you don't believe that this happens when the collapse occurs, and you think that of the collapse as something like a phase transition or something of that sort, in which degrees of freedom, in which energy or energy momentum is flowing from the degrees of freedom that have a metric description to the fundamental degrees of freedom of gravity, which make up a very different description, like the fluid description that is referred by the Navier-Stokes equation is at the fundamental level made up of atoms and photons that are not present in the equation, then I don't see any problem. In fact, you don't expect it to be particularly beautiful or anything like that if you take this, you know, operational view and effective view.
Well, thank you, everybody. Pub night starts at 5:30 downstairs. The same panelists.